Professor Vicky Caron, Emerita Professor of History and Jewish Studies, I would assume, at Cornell University. Thank you so much, Professor Caron, for coming to Madison and for welcome you back again after so many years. So we'll start at the beginning. Where were you born?
I was born in Chicago, although when I was, I guess, about 3.5 or 4, we moved to Skokie, so I grew up in Skokie, Illinois, which actually is a very interesting place, as you might know. Although
yes.
I don't think I ever really thought about it, unfortunately. I think the there were a lot of Jews living there then, too, from pretty assimilated backgrounds, but people really, a lot of Holocaust, you know, people who had survived the Holocaust, but I didn't really think about it very much at the time. My family background in terms of my parents belonged to a conservative synagogue. They themselves, I mean, were lower middle class. My father is an insurance salesman. I mean, but there was a strong sense of Jewish identity there as well, but nothing that would have necessarily predetermined me to go into the field of history.
So you went to public schools?
Yes, I went to public schools, mm-hmm. although I went to Hebrew mm-hmm. Hebrew school after school. Mm. But I went to a very good public high school, Evanston, and actually I did have 2 history teachers who were phenomenal there. So mm-hmm. I did get interested in history, but it took me a while to decide what to, focus on in school.
But you came from a Jewish milieu in the sense that your family identified as Jewish. They weren't overly religious in that identification, but you also came from a community that had a somewhat of a Jewish identity.
A very strong Jewish.
Yes.
I mean, most of the people were Jewish. Not everybody, but mm-hmm. the vast majority.
So the Holocaust was not in those years as central to Jewish identity that as it seems now. I mean, you could be Jewish in those years and not have a deep interest in the subject or knowledge of it?
Yes, although I think in my family, my mother's family, many of the members were in Poland, and so they lost.
Okay.
Although we never really talked about it very much, but it was always there in the background. And even in the Hebrew school where I went, I'd say that it was a big theme. Mm-hmm. Now there's a museum, a Holocaust museum in Skokie, which I have not yet visited. I think even then it was there, but not really mm-hmm. discussed explicitly a lot of times.
So where did you do your undergraduate work? Is that Illinois?
So I did my undergraduate work the first 2 years here, and that's where I first took Mossi's course. And again, as I mentioned before, that was the first time he had offered that course on modern Jewish history. And then, partly because I couldn't decide what I wanted to do, I had actually started here as a biology major,
mm-hmm.
but when I had to take a physics course and nearly failed, that ended that. And so I went into history, but I wasn't really sure. So I took a year off and went to Israel and went to an Olpan in Israel. And then when I came back, the tuition had gone up, and my parents said that they were encouraging me to go to the University of Illinois. So I went there and I got my degree there and actually finished within a year. But as I mentioned, Mossi's course did have a huge impact on me. What's funny about it is that He tried to kick me out of the course.
You're kidding. Oh, my God.
It was only, I think, that upperclassmen were going to get preference, and it was oversubscribed. And so I was a sophomore, but I was in an honors program that should have given me the right to be in there. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, you know, the X came down, and so I went to talk to him and discuss it. But Alex Orbach, who was the TA, told me to just be persistent and keep coming to the class, and other people would drop out because there was a very heavy workload there, which was true very quickly. Mm-hmm. People started to drop, and so I was able to stay in the course, and it was a terrific course. There were other students there, Nancy Green, who also was, I don't know whether you know her, but she hasn't been here to give a talk. She was in that same class, and both of us went on to pursue careers in French Jewish history.
Oh, that's amazing, because that course seems to have been quite influential in shaping people's subsequent careers, to some extent, anyway. We have the tapes of that course.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, I remember they had a service where they came and took notes. I probably don't have those notes anymore. Somebody officially took notes, written notes. Yeah, those were great, and you could keep those, and, you know, it's great for studying for exams. I do have my notes. I have my personal notes that I...
We would love to have those, but...
Really?
Sure. Yeah.
I can Xerox those.
Wonderful. We have the tapes, and we're actually going to use some of them for an online course we're doing, and some excerpts, and we're going to use some of it for another course. The course was heavily focused on Jewish, and German history.
Right.
And then Alex Orbach and a few others gave talks on Russia and the Bund. But that was the first time that most...
That was the very first time, so there was tremendous interest. It's true, though, on Eastern Europe, we actually read Isaac Bashevis Singer, The Family Muscat. So he gave us a novel. But I still remember, I'm sure you've heard this a zillion times, his discussion of his own encounter with East European Jews and how he came like in a limousine and was shocked at the, you know, these people have anything to do with me. So there's still, I actually, you know, probably remember that course better than, you know, most other courses. That I took. I also took a course with Harvey Goldberg, of course, who, even though he never dealt with Jewish issues, I found out later in his book on Jerez, he did deal with Jean Jerez's attitudes towards anti-Semitism, so he was interested in that as well. So, when I went to graduate school, I actually did apply here, but I ended up deciding to go to Columbia. And I worked there with Paul Hyman and Robert Paxton, who were terrific advisors.
So we can go right to Columbia. So you decide to study European history and then move into European Jewish history?
I went there to study actually Jewish history.
Oh, you did? So even in those years they had a graduate program in Jewish history?
Because Columbia was the first to have a graduate program in Jewish history because of Salo Barone. The person in charge at the time was Svi Ancori, but I ended up working with Paula Hyman, but she was just actually finishing her own degree at that time, so I didn't start working with her until like the second semester. I'm not sure I would have stayed had she not been there. There was also Arthur Hertzberg was there as an adjunct professor. But the Columbia program had been pretty well established. on the other hand, somebody with a background like I had from a much more secular, most of the students came from more religious milieu with a much better Jewish education. Mm. And I didn't have that traditional Jewish education. I had some background in European history, so I was actually coming in from a very different place. And in fact, well, the successor, Yosef Yerushalmi took over, I probably never would have been accepted into that program because I didn't have enough of a Jewish background. So, but I ended up working both in European and Jewish history, and that was really the strength of that program, just as it was the strength of this program, I think, as well.
Embedding Jewish history within the larger framework.
Yes, and that's really where I sort of, I think one of these questions asked about where, you know, I kind of situate myself. I mean, I've always felt that it was really important to embed Jewish history within that larger context. I mean, that's certainly where the field has moved now, but at that time that wasn't really the case. And yeah, so I think things were just beginning to change at that time.
So really in those years, you could say that that was the founding generation of Jewish studies in secular universities or public universities. I mean, I assume there had been Jewish studies in specifically Jewish institutions, but you didn't really see it too much in other universities up until...
No, although again at Columbia there had been this tradition because of Salo Barone, but maybe the generation in the 1960s where my mentor, Paula Hyman, people like Marian Kaplan in German Jewish history, and she had worked with Fritz Stern, Deborah Dash Moore, who's now at Michigan. So those people, I think, that's really, and maybe I'm in, and then the people like me in the 70s, yeah, but they were the first one, Todd Endelman, to really get jobs in secular universities and to really, you know, establish Jewish studies.
Those were the years when Mossy started to really move more towards Jewish history, too, mid to late 70s and into the
80s. Well, this was the course it was that I took. It had to be maybe in the spring of 72, or the maybe, I don't know, it was either the fall of 71 or the spring of 72.
I think it was probably the fall of 71, I think is what, One aspect of that course that I found amazing was that in the discussions with students and Professor Mossy, there was a profound lack of information on the Holocaust and on and a lack of understanding of the origins of this killer anti-Semitism in Europe and where this, and a kind of incomprehension of how this could have happened on the part of it. And you could really feel this almost deep emotional hurt or engagement in a subject that they knew very little about. And that was 1971. And so, and I would assume most of the students in the class were Jewish, but I found that because now you wouldn't find that to that extent. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but you would. I would think that the Holocaust is much more to the fore in not only Jewish education, but in education broadly, more broadly. So I found that quite striking in that discussion part of the course and how George responded to that.
No, I mean, there were books published that, you know, on Nazi Germany that hardly mention the Holocaust. So if one thinks about how that's changed now with, I mean, the huge expansion of work on the Holocaust, whether it's changed in high school curriculum, I don't know. When I ask students, they would sometimes say that they didn't. It was still a very minor part of what they, you know, did in high school or mm-hmm. learned even about the Second World War. So I'm not sure. But certainly I think in universities, I mean, it's really changed. I mean, that's mm-hmm. been the fastest growing, probably the fastest growing field of all, or certainly one of the fastest growing fields of all. But certainly in terms of my interest, I mean, that was, I'm interested in the same question again, how did this happen and what, you know, what are the roots? I mean, that was also when Raoul Hilberg's book was just being published, and I mean, I think that had a huge impact. I remember actually from in between when I took off, when I graduated, I still wasn't sure what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. Even now that I'm retired, maybe I'm still not sure. But and I remember I had this job in San Francisco. I went out to California for a while, and I was working in an insurance company. I was bringing Hilberg's book, like, to read at lunchtime. I think they, you know, probably thought I was crazy. But that was something, again, that, you know, I just heard about in Mossy's course. Hmm. And, yeah, so, I mean, that book, if one thinks about it with people like Christopher Browning, it just had a huge impact, I think. So, yeah, so, I mean, both anti-Semitism and the Holocaust are both fields that have developed tremendously since the 1970s. And even somebody like Robert Paston, with whom I worked at Columbia, really, it wasn't until they did the book, Vichy France and the Jews, that he wrote with Michael Maris, that I think he really realized that how prevalent or how important anti-Semitism was up until then. He had told Paula Hyman that she was putting too much emphasis really? On that in her book. So I do think, again, in the 70s and 80s, as you said, that people's attitudes were really changing.
Well, Christopher Browning is one of our graduate students from UW, and he got his PhD here. George was on his committee and worked very closely with him. He's a person I'd like to interview also at some point. Michael Maris studied with George too at some point. I'm not sure if it was at the Hebrew University or mm-hmm. here or what, but your main advisor was Paula Hyman, and I assume you and Professor Hyman were, there weren't that many other women in the field at that point, or was
it
fairly?
In our program, there were quite a few women, but she, as you might know, she was one of the first to really push for that, and I mean, she was an ardent feminist, and, but Marian Kaplan, Marcia Rosenblatt, another scholar. At Columbia, there were a lot of women in our graduate program. Not all of them went on to pursue careers in academia, but there were a lot of women there.
So your dissertation, how did you decide on your topic? How did you shape the direction of your research?
Well, I think I first chose a topic. I think it was something related to the Dreyfus Affair, that didn't really pan out. And so I took a year off and just did a lot of reading. I mean, I'm still interested in these issues of Jews and nationalism. Maybe Paula Hyman, too, was working on a book on the Jews of Alsace and Lorraine, but from an earlier period, so this seemed like a focus topic. It was. So that's how I got onto that. So, I mean, it worked out well with having Paula Hyman and Robert Paston as my advisors, but there's no family history or anything linking me to Alsace and Lorraine.
What were your experiences like in graduate school? Did you find the experience for you, I would never say graduate school is easy, but that it was enriching and supportive and that you worked with a great group of contemporaries, and or would you
have
a different
day? I mean, the way it ended up, I was very happy. I mean, it was difficult at the beginning. Uh-huh. Arthur Hertzberg wasn't always so invested in his students. Uh-huh. It was very small, and so there weren't really that many people to talk to, although mm-hmm. I have to say, when I look at the graduate program at Cornell, I mean, that's very tiny too, and so that's just the direction that graduate school has taken. Maybe I wasn't so integrated with the Europeanists there. I never actually even did a seminar in European history because the demands in Jewish, I'm not sure if this is still the case, but in Jewish history, you had to, for your comprehensive exams, do from biblical times to the present.
Oh, my God.
And so I had to take courses on, you know, the ancient Israel and the Jews in the Middle Ages. I think at a lot of places now you would do more European, you know, modern Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't have time really to take those. We were able also to take lecture courses and get credit for those. And again, for me, I had not that much background. So that was actually, a really good thing. So I did take a few lecture, courses.
Mm-hmm. Well, and being in New York and that whole incredible milieu there of lectures and culture.
And Columbia had ties mm-hmm. to the Jewish Theological Seminary mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. YIVO. So the resources were fantastic, and the lectures and the people coming through. So all in Leo Beck Institute. So all of that made New York a really good place, you know, to do graduate work.
So, to get back to Mossy for a bit, so you had this undergraduate course with him, and it sounds like you were quite influenced by his course and his teaching. So as you started to move into your career, how did his work have an impact on you? Did you find that it was an important influence on you as you move forward? And
I used his books in my courses up until the very end, especially the crisis of the German ideology. And sometimes the students would say, why are we using such an old book? I said, it's because it's the best one. I think actually, I mean, I don't, I only thought about this when I started to think about these questions. But in a way, like, I know some people criticize that book for defining the folkish ideology too broadly. And I think he may have changed. I actually didn't see the second edition, but I know he did some explaining mm-hmm. About why he did that. Yeah. But in a way, I think it's those broader definitions. I mean, he's not somebody that narrows things down. And I think that's the strength, really, of the book, to show how wide-reaching these ideas were. And it wasn't only anti-Semitic political parties or very specific anti-Semitic groups, but that this infiltrated everybody, religious groups, the conservative party. And I think that's how this worked. I mean, so that's really how I see it. I don't know if my view on that was came specifically from him, but that's just a view I think I share with him.
It sounds from your presentation today that's how you still approach the subject.
It's exactly how I approach the subject. I had a quote, I didn't mention this, but just on this issue, let me see. This is actually from his book. I actually use this. I like to have quotes at the beginning. I'm not sure they're going to let me keep this in the final version. This press doesn't do that, but I like to have these little introductory quote. So in one chapter, I did use a quote from him in his book, Toward the Final Solution. He said, Catholicism, as it evolved during the 19th century, like its Protestant counterpart, was separated from racism only by a thin line, which could be easily crossed. Baptism could not be denied, but the ancient hope of conversion was in the last decade of the 19th century overshadowed by hatred of the Jews. And I think that's exactly true. And so he did have a sense of how, you know, even religion and racism work together here. So, I mean, that's one way. And the other way I was thinking about, the other view I share with him is his view of how even the most assimilated Jews should be considered part of the Jewish community, because those people were often written out or not. Like a lot of the studies that were done maybe in the 1960s used only Jewish communal records. And so it was kind of an insular view. I mean, those were important works because it was new, and but I think David Weinberg's book does this, and certainly Paula Hyman's, you know, the people who use general archival sources too and go outside the Jewish community. And certainly in my book on refugees, I've never written on this, but you could see a lot of assimilated Jews writing in the mainstream press as Jews, though. They were identifying as Jews there, but they weren't really that involved with the Jewish community, and this was a more comfortable place for them. But most people don't look at those papers, so they don't even see, you know, that. So some of those discussions, and he always included, I remember he included, we read Trotsky on the Jewish question in that class. I mean, people like that, who some people would say, well, they shouldn't be considered Jews. But that's not my view. So I think that more sort of all-encompassing view of what Jewish identity is also more, it's also more my view as well. So
certainly that was something that would have had a personal resonance for him and his family, because they were very Jewish identified, but very secular also, right, and assimilated. Right. So, but so did you have any other interactions with Mossi over the years after that course when he came east to give talks? Or
I wasn't at Cornell when he was there as the A.D. White professor. I think I went to several lectures that he gave, and actually, I think the Journal of Contemporary History, I never discussed this with him, but the Journal of Contemporary History was the first place where I had an article published. So in that sense, he was, you know, very supportive. And even though he kicked me out of class, he always was very nice afterwards.
Oh, that's good. Yes, because in the years that I knew him, he... and even the decade before, he went out of his way to really mentor and support young women. I mean, before that, I think he had been accused of being somewhat sexist, or which, given the milieu that he came from, the environment, and the times, is perhaps not absolvable, but more understandable. But he really went out of his way to mentor younger historians such as Isabel Hull and many others. And so I wondered if you had been
I'm
part
sure
of that
I was,
group.
Or, as I said, I was accepted to work with him here in the graduate program, and I'm sure he would have done that. I remember I had gone once to ask him about doing an honors thesis with him in history. Maybe I thought I was going to continue on here. And he said, well, you can't do it unless you read German. Well, I didn't know German at that time. So
he could be such a stickler about those things, really.
So, but I think maybe that was part of my fear, you know, in terms of not coming here, that maybe I'd be better off, you know, working with French historians. So,
you know, it's interesting because so many of his PhD students ended up working in French history.
David Weinberg.
Yeah, there's just a lot of them. Robert Susi.
Oh, yeah, I do.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, there's quite a few. I wish I had the list. Is it Michael Oren? Oh, God, I can't remember. There's quite a few that wrote books in, significant books, it seems to me, in the field of French and French Jewish history. Because, like you said, he said German, but so many of his students ended up doing French history. Part of that might have been that he worked a lot with Harvey's students, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, that's really good. I mean, there was somebody else in French history here. Ed Gargan?
Oh, yeah, Ed Gargan.
And I think there was somebody else. I'm fucking his name. Who was also an emigre, a German emigre, isn't there? It started with an H. Anyway.
There was Ted. Well, there was Ted Hamerow, and he was in
yes,
Germany.
Yes, Hamerow.
Yeah, right,
yes.
Hamerow, right. Yeah. But.
Although, yeah, that's true. That wasn't French history. Well, you asked about my job.
Yes, and you know we covered the field of Jewish history a bit, and being a woman in that period.
Just one last thing to add on that, because my first teaching job was at the University of Washington in Seattle, and actually, I think. They had just made an offer to Stephen Ashheim, who I also was George Mossy's student,
right,
correct?
He was, yes, right.
And he had just made Aliyah and gone to Israel, but they really wanted him, so they actually didn't treat me so well. And they changed the terms. It was supposed to be a tenure-track appointment, but they changed the terms to, like, a one-year position. What was I going? Oh. Just in terms of, it was good that they were making an appointment in Jewish history, and there actually had been some people there. I think Deborah Lipstadt, she had already been there. The way the job was set up was not, the history department actually, I was told, didn't really want the position, which only shows that, you know, that Jewish history wasn't accepted as a legitimate discipline in history. So it was set up divided between history and religious studies and international affairs. It was a very complicated arrangement. And I think, it took a long time for these positions to really be recognized as legitimate fields within the discipline of history. It seems like here it's pretty integrated. But even at Cornell now, we don't have, now that I retired, my chair was offered to Jonathan Boyarin, who's an anthropologist, so there's nobody teaching Jewish history there now. And the people in the history department still don't really think that's a big problem. So sometimes, one can look at the field in a way and look at all the publications. And I have to say, at conferences now, Jewish history is totally accepted. I mean, there's so many panels on Jews, and it's great, and even many non-Jews working on this field. So to me, that's all terrific. But how accepted it really is in the profession, I don't know. I mean, had Jewish studies people not put up the money for so many of these chairs, I'm not sure how accepted it would be.
Without that.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yes, there certainly was a lot of resistance here. It took many, many years for it to be established here. And one of the main stumbling blocks was our Hebrew and Semitic Studies department, which didn't want to integrate into a larger Jewish studies program. And then we had a dean that was quite adamant that he wanted to resist this kind of ghettoization, he called it, of knowledge. And he didn't like all these fiefdoms being created, he said. So that took a long time, really. It was only in late 80s that finally Jewish studies was authorized here. But George, I think, taught one of the first specifically Jewish history courses in a public university, I would say. That was very early for that, in 1971. So So even here, it's always been a struggle, but I think that battle now is pretty much won.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always that same thing of trying to sustain and keep the positions you have and keep continuity as people retire. But, yeah. Well, I'm sorry to hear that, because I think Cornell should have a Jewish studies historian. I mean, someone in history in Jewish.
Well, that's a problem in history, because their Jewish studies is pretty much located within Near Eastern studies, and they, again, control the position. Mm-hmm. So they may hire a historian one day, but I'm not sure it would be somebody necessarily that would have a strong presence in the history department. We'll see. I hope that works out.
Well, you have been so helpful, and you've been talking now for the last 3 or 4 hours, and so I don't want to take up too much more of your time. But what would you consider your most important contribution to your field? Important publications, if you students that you've had that you feel especially notable?
Well, regarding students at Cornell, my graduate program was so small because I was the only Jewish historian.
Okay.
There were some people in European history. We had somebody, Mate Rigo, who actually I worked with Isabel Hull and Holly Case, who's an East Europeanist, and he just got his PhD last year, so he has some interest in some Jewish history interests for Romania and Hungary, but otherwise there weren't. There were a few. Federico Finkelstein, who works in Argentina, I mean, again, I think that, you know, what I always tried to do in my work again was integrate Jewish history into the broader fields of French or German, you know, just European history. And I think my work has been recognized in that way. I guess that I would consider that to be the major contribution.
Is there a book that you feel is the book you're most proud of, most influential, or?
I don't have that many.
I
think my last book, I thought that was a big, study that encompassed a lot of sources. And, I think it really sort of changed people's view.
This is the book on refugees?
And also by bridging, not looking only at the 30s, but sort of seeing continuities and discontinuities between the 30s and the Vichy period as well. So,
and the work you're doing now, going back to the 1890s and the early part of the 20th century, and then the post-World War I period and leading up to the war, but that sounds like it's a very vital and important topic, and
big.
We look forward to it. But thank you so much.
Thank you very, very much.
I don't take any more of your time. I